My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrads, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about the role of religion in foreign policy. We partly wanted to do that because it is Easter, and we're looking at the Easter holidays. But just before we started recording, we received the news item that Pope Francis actually died. And obviously, the Vatican and the Pope is one of the best examples of the importance of religion. Hi, Balder. First of all, how does it make you feel, right? Are you one of those who is kind of emotionally attached to the Pope? Because I know that Christians, non-Christians, Catholics and non-Catholics, some of them are more attached, some of them are less attached to the Pope.
Hi, Dario. Well, that's actually a good question. My attachment to the Pope is obviously not because of religion, because I'm not Catholic or Christian, but it is because of his politics. And I am sad in the sense that the Catholic Church is an institution that has enormous impact around the world, especially in the West, which is relevant for our podcast. And it matters whether the Pope comes from the conservative side or from the more liberal side. And this Pope decidedly was a more liberal, more progressive Pope, progressive in relative terms. In the Vatican, you can't really talk about progressive politics as such, but he comes from an angle, from a movement that I can relate to, or he came from that movement. And so in that sense, I'm also affected. I'm sad. I liked him as far as popes go, and I think it's going to be a very, very interesting few weeks to see who's going to be the next one, because there's going to be a fight in the Vatican between those two different sides.
I also think one of the reasons why the people generally like the Pope or figures such as the Pope is because they represent a certain degree of continuity. Right? I mean, I think there were very few people who weren't sad when Queen Elizabeth died, just because she had always been there, right? Whether you like the monarchy or not. But so just having someone there who also kind of so devoted to their position, right, that they believe, oh, my personal opinions are not as important as the well-being of the state, right? It's very similar to the Pope. And I think for the Pope, there's this added level of you can't really step down as the Pope. I mean, there's one who did it, right? Pope Benedict, the one before, did it. But there's such a level of dedication to this, right? Of, okay, I'm going to basically lead this church and I will do so until the day I die.
Yes, and that's the case even for those who are not Catholics or who call themselves Catholics but don't follow the Vatican. I think the symbolism that you mentioned with respect to Queen Elizabeth is exactly right when it comes to popes, right? There is a layer, an emotional layer, especially for people in the West or elsewhere in the Catholic world, that connect to the symbol of the Pope or the symbol of the Queen, especially if it is someone who's actually had some real impact on the organization, on the country, on the religion. And I think that's very much the case here. It's very clear that going from Pope Benedict to Pope Francis was a major shift in the way that the church looked at itself and the way that the church communicated to its flock. And I am sure that a lot of people are going to be affected by this, even those who are not Catholic themselves.
And particularly Pope Francis' kind of ideological outlook, I think, was very telling of the times that we lived in when he was chosen. Right. So if I remember correctly, this was around 2013, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. But there you had a Catholic Church kind of on the decline, right? More and more people leaving the church, not being happy with, for example, how certain scandals were treated, right? For example, the abuse of minors. So you had this reformer-like person that they chose. But that's no longer the world we live in, right? I mean, that's one of those, the major theme that we've been talking about for the last 1.5 years. I mean, this podcast has also existed for quite some time. But we've kind of been living in this constant, right, dark cloud over this world. And that actually leads to a situation where before the Catholic Church was declining, right? And I think the membership within religions, right, in the West, constantly on the decline. And this year, we're actually seeing something different, where They were just like read the numbers that came out of France, where they kind of revealed the highest number of ever the highest number of new entries of baptisms in the Catholic Church recorded in the last 20 years, right? Where it's basically from last year to this year, the increase is 45%. There's 10,000 people who got baptized in France basically this year already. And it's mostly young people, right? And that kind of shows you what times we're living in, when people are again turning towards religion because the rest of the world doesn't seem to be going so well anymore.
This is a very common pattern, of course. In times of confusion, in times of chaos, in times of fear, religion or the church, which is not exactly the same, right? On the one hand, you've got the church. On the other hand, you've got the religion. Provide not just comfort, but also some kind of meaning that is hard to distill in a world in flux, right? And that also shows that the church is not simply about believing God, right? Any kind of religion, any church or organized religion is a path towards some kind of meaning even here on earth, not just about the afterlife or not just about the divine will, but simply what are we doing here. And in that sense, Pope Francis, even before you look at the chaos that the world is suffering from at the moment, Pope Francis, with his background in liberation theology, his background in really political relevance, seemed to provide answers to people, right? In a way that Pope Benedict was incapable of doing, because Pope Benedict didn't have that that message that people could connect to. And then if you combine Pope Francis's own theological and philosophical background with a world that is completely messed up at the moment, you can understand why people are going back to the church, go back to trying to find meaning on Sunday morning, during Easter, etc., etc.
So this episode is basically a part two to the last episode we did on religion. It was, is the Western bubble a substitute religion, right? That was episode 72, and we actually recorded it last year at Easter, so on March 27th. Today we want to look a little bit more, right, less at the personal level, more at the institutional level. Right, just precisely looking at, okay, what is the role of religion, but also institutionalized religions or churches in foreign policy making. And when we, before we look at any of the right individual different branches of religion, right, or the different interpretations, let's look at it on a kind of more macro level, and the difference in religions kind of on just the interpretation of kind of faith or spirituality, and how that then kind of has an impact. And here the clearest difference is the one between hierarchy and structure, right? So there are religions such as Christianity, particularly with the Catholic Church, where you have the Pope, the Vatican, a clear authority. And then there's other religions where this is less organized and less hierarchical and more structured. And the extreme, like the other extreme here, right, if going from hierarchy to structure, would be Buddhism here.
Yeah, and the Catholic Church is absolutely the most hierarchical form, not just within Christianity, but worldwide. You can't get more hierarchical than the Catholic Church, right? It was set up at the end of the Roman Empire, very much also as a social construct, not just as a path towards the spirituality you mentioned or towards God, but as a very clear social construct. And you know, it goes perfectly, right? It goes from church, priest, bishop, cardinals, pope. I mean, can't have it more of a pyramid like that. And then you've got, on the other side, exactly, religions that are more like Buddhism, where it is actually not so much about creating a specific type of society or creating a specific type of structure, but it's much more about your individual connection to the spiritual, whatever spiritual might mean, right? I always find it a little bit difficult when people say I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. Then I want to ask, what does that mean? But that's where Buddhism can provide answers, right? Buddhism is exactly that. We don't have to listen to a priest or a bishop, I'm not Buddhist either, but there's no listening to authority figures. It is simply finding your own place in a complex cosmos, if you like. And that has very different implications for the impact of religion on international relations, on policy making, and on how countries perceive themselves, right? Buddhists don't go to war over their religion, and Catholics very much do. there, Buddhists typically don't go down a route of trying to convert others. They are happy to talk to you about their experiences, but it is not their mission to make you Buddhist. Catholics very much see it as their mission to make you Buddhist. And this is very clearly also visible in not just the difference between Catholicism and Buddhism, but the difference between the Abrahamic religions and other types of religions, right? Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are all very much based on this idea of spreading the word and making sure that everyone comes to believe in their version of God, whereas most other religions don't have that urge.
Well, spreading the word is expressed in a very diplomatic way almost, right? Because, yeah, there is that element of basically being a missionary, right? And trying to convince people through good deeds, through supporting them. There's also the other element, which the Abrahamic religions kind of share. And that's kind of spreading your religion through conquering others in the name of your religion, right? So that would be the Crusades for Christianity. That would be the Jihad for Islam, right? So there is this element within the Abrahamic religions of you better be my religion, you better be part of my club, otherwise bad things will happen to you.
And there's theological justification for that, right? If you're a true believer, true to the word, then you believe that those who do not follow Jesus Christ will not go to the kingdom of heaven. They will not be taken to paradise. And so it's almost like a moral duty to convince them, to make them understand that in the case of Christianity or in the case of Islam, Allah, that Jesus Christ is their personal Lord and Savior. That is a theological, moral, almost a duty that you have if you're a true Christian in the literal sense of the word. Now, most Christians nowadays do not interpret it that strictly, and I think it's fair to say that most Catholics, including the Vatican itself, by the way, do not believe in the literal interpretation of hell. So they don't have that moral construct that Abrahamic religions traditionally do, but there's still very much that kind of feeling that discomfort with someone not belonging to your religion, especially if you like them, because you would like them to be embraced by Jesus or by Allah. Then there is the political aspect, right? And it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. I would argue that probably the theological reasoning was very much constructed around a political structure. And there is the idea of, okay, it is actually incredibly useful politically, geopolitically, for us to say, hey, if you're not Christian, then we have a moral duty to convert you. And if we need to do that with guns, and if we need to do that by force, then we'll do so. Because that, of course, allows an enormous freedom in terms of conquest, in terms of war.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would, right, the moment you started the sentence, I didn't immediately think of the conquest part. I more thought about the internal politics, right, because it's also an incredibly useful tool to control your in-group. But of course, once you have control of your in-group, you might as well expand that in-group towards the
out-group. Right, Buddhists are like cats. They go in every direction. You can't put them in a herd. And with the utmost respect for Christians and Muslims around the world, in many Abrahamic religions are more like sheep, right? You are more docile because you have to follow your religious leadership. Even in the case of Protestantism or Islam, where it's not hierarchical, but there's still a very clear imposition from above on how you should behave, which creates, exactly as you say, an in-group, us versus the outsiders who do not follow that pattern. This is probably mostly visible in, for example, Judaism and Islam, more so than Christianity, the enormous set of almost random, I mean, I say that as someone obviously who is not an insider, but almost artificial rules that people have to follow, right? Jewish people on the Sabbath, Muslims, when it comes to alcohol, for example, or well, you could have to say that with alcohol there is a social need as well, but the rules are very much there to make sure that you belong to us, that you belong to the in crowd. And by being an Orthodox Jew and following all those rules, even though some of those rules have no practical impact on society, no practical impact even on your own health or on yourself, you're signaling to the rest of the world and towards yourself, I am with this elite group who understand reality. And the outsider is different and does not belong to us. And that creates enormous social cohesion.
Well, I mean, I would argue that most, I mean, I can't think of too many rules within the Abrahamic religions that didn't have a practical application during the time when they were invented. And so they might seem out of date now, but again, this goes back to my interpretation that most institutionalized religions, so in form of churches, were always used as a form of control and power. And yeah, of course, if you people don't drink, and you might not have any hooligans then roaming around the streets, right? They might help. Same with the Sabbath, because if you ask me, that's basically to make sure people take a break and that they don't overwork themselves, and that they therefore there's a higher quality of living and more longevity within your people.
Yeah, I think I used alcohol erroneously, because alcohol actually is a very clear social issue. But for example, if you look at the Sabbath, there's absolutely this idea of, hey, everyone needs a break, and also to protect people, right? To protect everyone, the poor and the rich, but especially the poor, from not having to work on at least one day a week. That makes perfect sense. But then if you look at the enormous list of rules that are associated with that, there is no practical use to it, right? For example, why can't you switch on a light, electricity at home? There's absolutely no reason why that should... the same with why can't you plant certain crops next to each other? Why can't you touch a pigskin? Those are not... Now, there might be in the past all kinds of reasons that were there, but nowadays they don't make any sense. Why can't you put cheese? Why can't you have a cheeseburger? If you do, you know, that kind of thing. We can explain it from the past, but why people do it now is not because there is a practical impact, but because it gives you a belonging. It makes you part of us versus them.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Right. I think we both argue the same thing, just from different perspectives, as always. We agree too much, Paul. We need to disagree more. Right. There's one. I'll give us something to disagree over. Not with each other, but with a guy. Huntington, right? All international relations students or former international relations students who are listening to us know what we're talking about. But for the ones who might not know what Huntington's Clash of Civilizations is, it was this paper, and based on this paper, a funny looking map that Huntington basically created, where he said, at some point these civilizations, they will inevitably clash with each other, right? There's no way that they can coexist. And he basically then created the Western world, right, where you have North America, not Mexico, Europe and Australia. Then you have Latin America, right? And then you have the Muslim world, right? Where Indonesia and Somalia and basically North Africa and the Middle East are kind of part of one group. And then you have the Orthodox world, you have China, but out of China you have carved out a little Buddhist area, right? So, and then you have India as its own thing. So it's this whole map that really, I mean, it looks like a first year international relations student created this map thinking, oh, I really did something here, but not a maybe formerly well-respected thinker.
Yeah, and that map is very much influenced by religion, right? It is, the hilarious thing is that there are many different versions of that map, even by Huntington himself, and certainly his followers afterwards. But what you see is a very static understanding of the world where you can identify groups, and it's not necessarily that they can never get along, but the argument is that those civilizations will never be able to integrate into each other. So the whole struggle of humanity is to balance those civilizations and not let them continuously go to war, because they're always clashing with each other. And there's no way that you can, you know, turn two civilizations into one. It's a very static, very reactive, reactionary kind of view of the world. And there is really no proper justification for the maps that Huntington drew, except when it comes to some very broad understanding of religion, right? As if the moment that you belong to a religion, that already then defines who you are at every other level. And that's where you get really weird maps where you've got Pakistan connected to Senegal, for example, or Indonesia, because they all have Muslim populations, which of course doesn't make any sense. Senegal has nothing to do with Indonesia, and Indonesia has very little to do with Pakistan, ethnically, culturally, historically. But for Huntington, that religious aspect was enough to divide people into those static civilizations.
Right, going away from this part, right, and how you can look at the world, right, look at the world of foreign policy and look at it through a lens of religion, right? So kind of going away from this, because it really just doesn't make a lot of sense. There are some very real aspects, right, that we can look at when it comes to the impact of religion on foreign policy. So we already mentioned, right, the difference between more hierarchical, more kind of structured religions, right? We looked at Abrahamic religions and kind of how they have been formed. And then there's obviously the thing, or the aspect of, you can also use religion as a tool to legitimize your policy, right? So it's not so much that the religion influences the policy, right? So the Pope calling, calling the German Chancellor and saying, hey, yeah, you really need to do this. But more the German Chancellor saying, well, you know, because, this is kind of originates from our interpretation of Christianity. That's the reason why we really need to follow this policy. And that's the reason why we're doing it.
Yeah, and where it gets complex is that there is often that mixed belief, right? We like to, when we analyze, we like to separate different motivations. But for the German Chancellor or for your Spanish king in the 16th century, they are religious and they view the world from their religious perspective. And out of that comes the policy. And some of that is very convenient. But it's not that they simply, oh, now I'm going to just manipulate religion for my own benefit. It's more complex than that. So you mentioned the Crusades. The Crusades had very clear political aspects, but they were basically a political project. They weren't a religious project, but religion was always there as a driver and it always justified it all. The conquest of the Americas, especially Latin America, South America, was very much driven by this belief of we need to civilize, Christianize, convert the local populations, if necessary, by force. The fact that there were also lots of silver and gold mines that were incredibly useful to fill the Spanish and Portuguese coffers, yeah, that went parallel with that, right? But it goes beyond that. It's not just about conquest. It's not just about warfare, but it's also about how you want to view the world. And the liberal project that the Western bubble, our podcast, is so focused on, that liberal idea of the whole world turning into democracy and turning into free capitalist society, also borrows a lot from its religious roots. For example, when it comes to human rights is very much founded in Christianity, in natural rights. Thomas Aquinas, 15th to 14th century monk, the idea that we all are endowed with some kind of divine spiritual value, and that endows us with certain rights that every government has to respect. So religion basically allows us to turn the world into our own image and to justify us doing so. And whether that's through the Crusades or human rights, it's the same pattern. And a lot of people who hate the Crusades love human rights, but they have to acknowledge this aspect, right?
a fundamental aspect of the Western bubble. Let's actually look at the different religions, right? And so here, this is a non-conclusive list, but those are kind of the ones that we wanted to focus on, particularly because of the Western bubble, right? And let's start here with the Catholic Church, just because, right? Pope Francis just died, but also because the Pope is the clearest kind of tool to influence foreign policy, or also domestic policy. And particularly this Pope, particularly Pope Francis, has become even more active than others, right? Particularly on topics such as peace, right? Kind of driving peace, calling for peace. I remember he was one of the first kind of actors within the West to call for peace in Gaza. Before anyone else did it, right? He always advocated for humane treatment of refugees and migrants, something hugely unpopular within Europe and in North America right now. Within the Catholic Church, you clearly have the Pope.
Yeah, if you do religion right, and I think this Pope, I mean, I know that, look, Pope Francis wasn't perfect, of course, and it's very easy to criticize him. I think that people have to understand that he was still heading an incredibly conservative, slow-moving institution. So even if you have all the right ideas, it's very difficult to take that whole institution with you, right? There's a lot of backstabbing, internal politics within the Vatican, etc. But if you do religion right, and I think Pope Francis really tried to get it right, you basically remind people of common basic human values, and you take them away from the idea of hatred, the idea of violence, right? We've often in this podcast, I've often quoted Martin Luther King, very much using a religion as a source for peace and connection and bringing different groups together. If it's done wrong, badly, then it can go completely in the other direction, right? And it can tear society internally or externally apart. The Spanish Reconquista, which here I live in Spain, and in Spain it's still taught in schools as something positive, in many ways was terrible news for other religions, right? Under Muslim rule, there was a lot much greater tolerance than under Christian rule after 1492, when the whole Spain became Christian once again. So it's one of those cases where you can see, if you study the Catholic Church and its very hierarchical structure, you can see when it's done in a way that is productive, constructive, where it actually helps people, or where it can be incredibly destructive and actually make the world a significantly worse place. The other aspect that might be interesting to analyze here, Dario, is the difference between how the Catholic Church influenced Latin America versus how Protestantism influenced the United States, and how the United States therefore positioned itself very differently in international relations than Latin America has.
I mean, starting with this, and here again, my heart as an international relations student kind of like is beating a bit faster right now, because you always look at it through, okay, what's the different setup of North America versus South America, right? And what was the different approach to colonization? And then also, very interestingly, for the Western bubble, how did that approach how does that differ in how the countries are set up, right? While the Catholic colonization was very much focused on extracting something, but kind of set, like replacing existing structures with their own. In North America, it was a bit more Protestant and a bit more, right? Also business driven, almost capitalist driven, right? Kind of saying that, oh yeah, this is not financed by the Vatican here, but no, we're going out there as a business and we're setting this this project up as a business. And I think you can see that difference within foreign policy as well.
Absolutely. And it's not just the business driven aspect, but North America, the United States in particular, was politically as well as religiously a rejection of the old, right? It was Protestants who are, Protestants, the name says it, it's protesting against the former church, against the Vatican. Protestants who escaped Europe to do something new. And they didn't have a Protestant pope because there is no hierarchical structure within the Protestant churches. That told them, oh, you have to behave. So Protestants all of a sudden were free to create a new project in the United States. Whereas in Latin America, the Catholic Church was a major factor in allowing the political establishment basically to copy the template from Spain and Portugal onto Latin American countries that were that wanted to be independent from the Spanish and Portuguese crowns, but didn't have any interest in renewal, didn't have any interest in trying to do things differently. And the Catholic Church very much encouraged, hey, look, if you're going to be independent, make sure that you're still good Catholic children. Make sure that you still behave according to the rules that we set in Rome. And then we hopefully will can all get along. So there's this huge contrast between a American, U.S. Project that basically throws out the old and tries to do something completely new, and religion facilitates that because Protestants are already protesting against the old hierarchy versus the old hierarchy in Latin America that basically enables politicians to continue their path as they've always have. And the consequence of that is that the United States turned into a booming force in international relations and the dominant superpower of the 20th century, whereas Latin America has never actually been able to position itself like that because it's always been struggling with those class struggles, with the hierarchy versus populism, the idea of the old versus the new. It has never been able to have a new project like the United States did. And it's one very, very interesting explanation of why countries like Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Peru, etc. have not played a more proactive role in international relations, because they never had that foundation that the United States had.
That very foundation, I feel like it's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons for the U.S. decline at the moment, because of that rejection of hierarchy. You always have this, right? I mean, there's this joke that within these Protestant churches in the United States, if basically someone disagrees with the current leader of the church, then he just goes away and creates a new church, right? So you have this constant fragmentation of different religious groups, right? From the Protestants, but I mean, also now very much the evangelicals. And that has formed an incredibly powerful interest group within the US, but one that's not so uniform, right? They don't have the same and a clear message, and there's a lot of, right, competing against each other, but trying to go for influence, and they are very, very powerful drivers there, within US policy, not seeing that their kind of interests and their influence in politics has a detrimental effect, kind of the US position in the world.
Yeah, I've argued in the past that the decline in the United States started after the Second World War, the decline of U.S. power and hegemony, and that may seem like a weird statement because the second half of 20th century, especially the 1990s, is typically the time period where we all look at the United States as being at the peak of its geopolitical power. But I think underneath there was already something rotting. There was something that the project had lost power, had lost drive. But if you then look at specifically at religion, a major, major component of that decline in the second half of 20th century was the 70s, when evangelicals actually decided to start voting. Until the 1970s, evangelicals didn't vote, because that's not like politics is not for us. We are not interested in politics. We're interested in our relationship with God and spreading the word. And if we get into politics, then it becomes like a dirty business. But in the 70s, partially because of some leaders that we now know as neoconservatives, on the Republican side of the political spectrum, they convinced evangelicals to actually go and tell their flocks to vote. And they did that with the promise that if you become this voting bloc, then in exchange, we will give you some of the things you want. Support for Israel, internal anti-abortion politics, those kinds of things. And at that moment, you see all of a sudden religion becoming much, much more influential and powerful, and therefore probably detrimental to the health of the US system than what it had been until that moment.
Let's go back a few centuries. to England, because in England you had with King Henry the 8th or the 7th or the 6th, I don't know, one of the many Henrys, he basically formed and created the Church of England, despite the fact that the Church of England is not so different from the Catholic Church, is it?
Yeah, I'm kind of shocked that you don't know that this is Henry VIII. I mean, Henry VIII is one of those figures that every person should know, just for many reasons.
I knew it was a Henry.
well done. You got half of it right. So Henry VIII started the Church of England. And the fascinating thing is that even though the Church of England is typically, the Anglican Church is typically put in the box of Protestant churches, Reformed churches, basically those who rejected the power of the Vatican. In many ways, theologically, the Church of England is just a lighter version of the Catholic Church. Theologically speaking, it's not, it's got very little to do with Lutherans or Calvinists or the true Protestants, right? It was purely a political choice. And then after that, you've got Church of England theologians who try to distinguish themselves from the Church of England, and you see the two separate. Whereas the Protestants had their theology before they started Protestantism. They started thinking about things and they started rejecting the way that the Catholic Church viewed the world and viewed their relationship with God, etc., etc. In the Church of England, it was the other way around. First, there was a political choice. Let's create our own church. That way, I can marry who I want and I can do my own thing. And the Pope doesn't have any power over my domain. That was basically the choice that was being made. And then in the centuries after that, you see theology trying to actually create some kind of identity that isn't a carbon copy of the Catholic Church, which is fascinating, and it shows how religion can be very directly, very practically a tool for global leaders.
And then it became an important tool for further politics in the 15th and 16th century.
Hugely important, and the Church of England became a player, not directly, not militarily, as far as I know, but certainly indirectly when it came to financing and politics within the religious conflicts, within the politics of continental Europe in the 16th and 17th century. It became a major player when it came to the Peace of Westphalia, etc., etc., even though they really did not have to fight that fight, they were still very much involved in terms of financing and support. Interestingly enough, by the way, just on a side note, the religious wars, which were typically, you know, the Catholic Church versus Protestants, also saw Catholic France siding with the Protestants for geopolitical reasons, right? So in that case, France said, okay, we're looking at this fight between the Vatican and the Holy Roman Emperor and the Protestants. And yeah, theologically speaking, we should kind of side with the Pope, but actually we don't want the Holy Roman Emperor to become too powerful, so we're going to side with the Protestants instead, which is, again, a fascinating dynamic between religion and politics.
I mean, there's another case study that's very recent, and that's when you had the Eastern Orthodox Church suddenly be split into a big one, the Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, after Russia decided to invade Ukraine. And suddenly you're there as a priest, and you're looking at this and saying, one second, I mean, I know we're very similar, but that doesn't mean that we necessarily need to be incorporated into Russia here.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, in some ways to Protestantism, they had their own structures, but there was the Eastern Orthodox churches that were joined together. And then the Ukrainian Orthodox Church basically completely sided against the Russian Orthodox Church, or vice versa, because of the war, pure politics. And I think here, more than anything, the reason for this breakup between the two in terms of coordination, in terms of working together, it lies firmly on the side of the Russian Orthodox Church that basically turned into a political tool, right? The Russian Orthodox Church in the 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, took a very political position and then basically signed a contract with Putin and said, Hey, we will support you if you support us in order to spread the word of orthodoxy after atheists, the Soviets, denied our right to exist. Now we want to grow again. And as a result, the Russian Orthodox Church has very, very little to do with actual spirituality of her theology and is purely a political machine that supports the current regime in the Kremlin.
I mean, this is also a great, I think, moment to insert another element of how religion impacts foreign policy. So we just saw a quasi-ceasefire of 30 hours imposed by Putin because of Orthodox Easter, right? Because they said, hey, there's a religious holiday. We usually see this also with Ramadan, that whenever there's a conflict somewhere in the Muslim world, right, there's either a break during Ramadan. So you have that element of religious holidays where people kind of luckily calm down a little bit. And that's always a nice little, right, it's a nice way to kind of save face while you might want to negotiate in the background or at least take a break.
And also that last bit, right? So that take a break, the famous moments of Christmas during the First World War, and apparently also in certain local situations during the Second World War, where soldiers are just desperate for a moment that they don't have to shoot each other. And then if as long as you're both Christians or as long as you're both Muslims, then at least you can agree that, hey, this is a moment that we should just stop for a moment. And you can see how politics, war, and religion mix into this very complex psychological game. Now, the way I understand it, by the way, is that Putin announced this also because he wants to show himself to be respectful of Christianity, of course, because of his deal with the Orthodox Church. But in reality, not much actually changed. I mean, it was a declared ceasefire, but the violence actually continued.
Yeah, exactly. It was a quasi ceasefire, which, I mean, apparently,
which was messaging.
Yeah. Exactly, right? Which again shows you, right, how sometimes religion is used to legitimize politics. The poor religion is always being used. Well, for the longest time, it was also using politics. So I think that's fine. another, right, very interesting kind of religion to look at with this and two different branches is Islam. Looking at Sunni and Shia Islam, right, where Sunni Islam theoretically, and I'm saying this because in reality, sometimes it's different, but theoretically is a bit more kind of prone to power, right? It's used more as kind of a power tool there, right? It has a better relationship with monarchy. And then you have Shia Islam, which theoretically is more the theological kind of part, right? Where they reject to use Islam as a form of power tool. But in reality, particularly for Shia Islam in Iran, that looks a little bit different. You could say that Ayatollah Khamenei is a quasi king in Iran.
Yeah, with some, I would argue with a few caveats, right? With a few footnotes there.
Many footnotes.
So it's not a coincidence that it's in Shia Islam that you create a theocracy. Some of my students over the years have written that Saudi Arabia is a theocracy. No, Saudi Arabia is not a theocracy. Saudi Arabia is a monarchy that uses religion for its political purposes. Iran is a theocracy, literally, but also in spirit. Right, so the position of the Ayatollah is not nowhere near as clear as the position politically, I mean, as the position of the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, for example. The position of the Ayatollah is one very much as a religious leader, someone who has enormous political influence and in the end is the one who decides the direction of the country. But there's also a president, there's also a government, and that president and government have autonomy in many areas and do not have to follow instructions. In fact, the Ayatollah and religious leaders are often not interested in specifics. They see themselves as this connection with God, with Allah. And that is something that is often misunderstood in the West, right? So the Iranian political situation is much more complex and much more nuanced in some ways than, for example, Saudi Arabia has ever had.
Yeah. And that leads to, right, I mean, then to these interesting dynamics where you already mentioned that obviously the Saudi, particularly the Saudi royal family, again uses religion to legitimize its own rule. Right, there was for many years there was this interesting kind of power play where you weren't really sure who is more powerful, right? Is it kind of the clerics or is it the royal family? I think in recent years we've seen a clear shift there between that. So you have right, you have them kind of rejecting the use of religion for power, which is also one of the reasons why they despise political Islam so much, right? Where they say no, please keep religion out of politics. We don't do that over here, right? Kind of seeing the irony in that. And there's patterns, right? Patterns you start to recognize when it comes to domestic policy, foreign policy, and religion.
Absolutely, and it has very direct impact on the real world. So, for example, I would argue, yes, there has been this power struggle between clerics and the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, but the House of Saud is in charge, has always been in charge. It's just that sometimes they had to listen a little bit more to the clerics than at other moments in time. And there is very little evidence that they themselves are actually particularly religious. But they use the idea of guardians of Mecca, the idea of leaders of the Sunni world, less philosophically complex than, for example, Egypt, right? Egypt would be another Sunni power, but Egypt has much more intellectual and philosophical debate and movements that muddy the waters. Saudi Arabia, by having a monarchy that uses religion to clearly state, no, we are clear protectors of Mecca and clear protectors of Sunni Islam, has the impact that they automatically have difficulty connecting with Iran. In fact, a large part of the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran is because Saudi Arabia needs to project this Sunni defense against Shia Iran. And it leads to Saudi Arabia investing very heavily in a religious education around the world, specifically sub-Saharan Africa, for example, Huntington's drawings, right, where Saudi Arabia is investing millions and millions in schools in the Sahel region, in countries such as Mali, in countries such as Senegal and elsewhere, in order to basically make sure that they can connect to other parts of the world through religion and then reap the political and geopolitical benefits.
And just to kind of bring this back to the Western bubble a little bit, right? Again, those are all Abrahamic religions. And here you see that lately, you kind of see that attempt to reconnect between the Christian world, right? So the Pope, also the Orthodox churches, with kind of the leaders of the other ones to kind of regain importance in this ever more secularizing world. But you also see that Abrahamic kind of cover thrown over politics with the Abraham Accords, right? The ones that our dear leader, sorry, I can't stay serious with this man, but that our dear leader Donald Trump came up with in his first presidency, right? Where he kind of used that saying that, oh, you know, we're all the same basically, right? We're kind of the Abrahamic religions. We disagree on who the prophets are, but you know, we're all kind of the same. And let me use kind of this cover of religion here to normalize, like to kind of pressure countries to normalize relations, right, between the Sunni Arab world and Israel.
And this is in direct response to this rise of secularism, right, which has halted now, not just because of the chaos of the moment, but over the past 5 to 10 years, you see that atheism and secularism are no longer on the rise in the West, but also not elsewhere, whereas in the 1990s and in the early 2000s, there was a huge, basically decline in the power of religion worldwide, because people became more secular, they became less spiritual, or at least less religious. And religion saw that, and they thought, okay, look, there's one enemy that is worse than the other religion, and that is atheists who don't believe in God at all. Opinion polls clearly showed that the least trusted politicians in the United States during the war on terror were not Muslim politicians, and I'm saying this because the war on terror was very much Christianity versus Islam, but were atheist politicians. You could in many cases get away with saying I'm Muslim, but you couldn't get away with saying I'm atheist. That has changed a little bit now, but there was this clear fear for the rise of secularism. And it makes sense, right? I would argue that I've never met a intelligent, truly intelligent religious person, whether it's Islam or Christian or anything like that, who doesn't see their religion as a vehicle to God rather than the absolute truth. Because of course, it's very hard intellectually to make the case that your specific understanding of all the details of God are correct if you've got billions of people who have a different interpretation. So anyone who says, hey, I'm a Christian because I believe that my Catholic Church or my Protestantism allows me to connect to God also understands that a Muslim tries to do the same through Islam and therefore finds it much easier to connect to that Muslim person than to an atheist who completely denies the existence of God or at least doesn't believe that the God exists.
Mm. Let's move on to the last kind of religion that's relevant to the Western bubble, and that's Judaism. And we see this particularly with regards to Israel, and we've recorded a lot of episodes, right, on that, and on that interplay between the West, certain feelings about guilt of the past, and Jews within Israel, which is already the main problem, right? Because sometimes it's a bit, the lines are a bit blurry of, okay, where does the state of Israel begin and where does the religion end, which is sometimes conveniently kind of thrown together.
Well, the first complexity starts with the unique position that Judaism has, where you are Jewish ethnically, as in by bloodline, through your mother, and you can be Jewish religiously, right? And it's not easy, unlike Islam and Christianity, it's not easy to become Jewish. It's a much harder, tougher hill to climb. But the combination of those two together already creates complexity. So if you are now criticizing something about the religion, about the Jewish religion, about some aspect of Judaism, I don't know, the Torah, the Old Testament, are you immediately anti-Semitic? Well, that depends on how you define it. Do you define anti-Semitism as against anyone who is Jewish, either secularly or religiously? Or do you define it as something else? And that becomes then a much bigger problem when it comes to Israel, right? So Israel is very much a state that is created because of religion. It is a state that even though it's in the constitution secular, it is there to defend Jewish people against ever being the minority again after the Holocaust, after the crimes of the Second World War. The state of Israel was basically there to say never again, Jewish people have to feel safe. And as a result, we need to have a place that we can call our own and we're not part of this diaspora where we're always the minority in other parts of the world. And then the question is, okay, so now if you're critical of what Israel does, is that inherently, immediately anti-Semitic? Intellectually, I think it's very easy, the answer to that. The answer is no. You should be able to criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic. But it's a complex situation, right? Because this is a state that exists to protect Jewish people. And so if you criticize that state, if you criticize the behavior of that state, do you actually immediately criticize Judaism itself? And that makes the whole conversation so very, very frustrating to have, especially when you see the enormous violence and slaughter that has happened over the past year and a half. You notice every time that someone raises their hand and tries to point out that what Israel is doing is not right, is enormously destructive, enormously murderous in many ways, then straight away you get, oh, so you're anti-Semitic, and you get put into a corner. And the moment that label anti-Semitism gets raised is the moment that Western media jump at you. and say, so we can't take you seriously because we don't deal with anti-Semites.
This is such an interesting conversation. I think most likely next year, Easter, we will potentially have a part three, because there's also some religions that we haven't talked about yet, but we're slowly but surely running out of time. I mean, I think it would be very interesting maybe next year to, or maybe even sooner, it depends, to look at, right, on different just forms of spirituality, right, which are kind of growing in the West. But then we've also, we've only focused on kind of religions that are very close to the West right now, but for example, Confucianism, we need to talk about China at some point, or Buddhism, maybe Hinduism, right? There's a long list of religions left that we will have to analyze soon.
You know, absolutely. Both China with its Confucianism and Modi's India with Hindu nationalism are directly, their foreign policy behavior is directly influenced by religion. And so I think it would be worthwhile doing a follow-up, maybe in the foreseeable future rather than next year.
But for now, this seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the role and the impact of religion on foreign policy. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
It seems fitting to take a quote from the now, unfortunately, late Pope Francis, who I still, like I said at the beginning of this episode, admire despite obvious flaws. And he said, "No amount of peace building will be able to last, nor will harmony and happiness be attained in a society that ignores, pushes to the margins, or excludes a part of itself. It loses something essential. We must never, never allow the throwaway culture to enter our hearts. No one is disposable."